Spencer, and this is the first of five sessions on focusing on the church in Central America. Before I get started, I'd just like to see how many folks here have traveled in Latin America, you know, or even more specifically in Central America, but Latin America first. You have some folks. And how many folks have dabbled with or interested in liberation theology? You have read some or heard some of that? Okay. What I would like to do this week is focus on the church in Central America. I work at Augsburg College at a program of Augsburg called the Center for Global Service and Education, and I'm the Latin American coordinator there. A lot of what we do is organize and lead travel seminars for church people to Mexico and Central America, focusing on the church in the current situation there, the situation of human rights and displaced people, and how we as North Americans, and particularly North American Christians, are called to respond to that situation. And I found that by looking at Central America through the eyes of the church, it's oftentimes a helpful way for we as North Americans to begin to understand some of the dynamics and the situation, the history that's going on there. Oftentimes when we begin to talk about places like El Salvador or Nicaragua, it can become a very polarized conversation very quickly with people taking sides, and all of a sudden you're talking about, is this person communist, is this person so forth and so on. But I think if we start a little bit differently and look at the church and our relationship to people involved in the church there, we can begin to ask questions that help us get around some of the early obstacles. What I'd like to do in the session today is give us a framework for understanding the different tensions and dynamics within the church there. And so I'm going to, it's a rather ambitious project in the sense of covering about 450 years in 30 minutes or so. But I'm going to go very briefly through the early first several centuries of the church and focus on the last two decades, particularly since 1960 or so, both on the current events in Latin America and how they've affected the church, and on the development within the church and how the church has affected the current events there. And as we then, let me just show you what we'll be doing the rest of the week. Tomorrow then I'm going to focus on one particular strain of the church. I'm labeled as the Church of the Poor, but we'll be looking at the phenomenon that is known as base Christian communities and the theology that has come out of that, which has been called Latin American liberation theology, among other things. We'll focus more specifically on that, but I hope to set up the groundwork for understanding how that Church of the Poor is emerging. And then on Wednesday, we'll look at liberation theology and how it has emerged out of this context, what it says to us, what it says to the people in Latin America. Then on Thursday and Friday, we'll focus specifically on the church in El Salvador and the church in Nicaragua. And I think having come up through these first sessions, we'll be able to understand some of the things then that we read in the newspaper about, for example, a bishop being expelled from Nicaragua or four American churchwomen being killed in El Salvador. What's the context that lets us understand those? But I think we'll get started now then just looking at the historical perspective of the church. The one thing I think is oftentimes difficult for us to understand as North Americans is how very different in many ways the Latin American church is. If we're used to a model that has kind of the local church on the corner with a pastor and maybe 300 or 400 parishioners, that's very different than what people would understand as a church if you lived in Latin America. There's a very small clergy that covers a very large amount of lay people in the church. And it's not uncommon to have parishes, particularly this is within the Catholic Church, parishes that may encompass 20 or 30,000 people per priest. And so that sets up a very different dynamic and within the church, a very different understanding of people's relationship to the church. I'm going to, in these early sessions anyway, focus on the Catholic Church, since that's by far and away the dominant church in Latin America. And then later on, we can start talking about some of the influences of the Protestant churches, because when we look at El Salvador, I'd like to talk particularly about the Lutheran Church in El Salvador. And we'll also talk about that a little bit tonight at Vespers. If I were to write up this date here, what would be your immediate response? 1492. One of two very important things that, in terms of Latin America that happened in that year. You know, that was the year that Columbus first landed in the Americas, and the first European influence from the Mediterranean region began to reach the Americas. But another equally important thing for the church that developed out of this is that 1492 is the last year that the Moors, that the Muslims, were in Spain. Spain had been occupied by them, by the Muslims from northern Africa for many centuries, and there had been a whole holy war of Christians versus Muslims through this time. And 1492 was when the last Muslims were expelled from Spain. This becomes very important in understanding what kind of theology came over with the early Spanish and Portuguese conquerors in Latin America, because they brought a theology or an understanding of the church very much tied to a holy war ethic, very much tied to understanding Christians as the children of God and everyone else as the infidel or pagans or something other than or very separate from us. And this thing was carried over, and what was natural then when the Spanish and the Portuguese found other peoples living in the Americas, particularly the Indians, that they would react in a very similar way they had to the Muslims. These were different people. These were people that were meant to be conquered. The people were meant to be converted. Also, because of the historical context, there was a very, very close alliance between the church and the crown during this time. And so with the very first ships that arrived, you have missionaries as well. And so you have, on the one hand, the sword and the cross going together, the sword conquering the people, the cross and the missionaries converting them as soon as they can to Christianity. And oftentimes people were given the choice of being killed or converting, so they had a fairly high conversion rate in the early years there. Although the diseases and the warfare that the Spanish and Portuguese brought over decimated the population of the Indians. The other thing that was going on was very important for understanding the mentality within the Catholic Church. It took place a few centuries or a few decades later, but that was the whole Reformation with Martin Luther and John Calvin and the theology that was developing among certain parts of the church that then began to split the church. The result within the Catholic Church was the Counter-Reformation, where the Catholic Church began to emphasize everything that had to do with orthodoxy, with obedience, with hierarchy, with all of the tenets of the faith that were being challenged by the Protestant reformers. And so this also then was the kind of theology that was being brought over. And the result was a church that emphasized in its relationship to its lay people a theology of submission, a theology of domination, a theology that emphasized hierarchy, and particularly a theology that emphasized a lot of dualism. There were very, very sharp distinctions made, for example, between heaven and earth, between one's soul and one's body, between being a member of the clergy and a member of the laity. And each one had a very sharply assigned role to it. This was very convenient for the Spanish, in particular, in carrying out the conquering of the Americas, because they had developed a very tight alliance between the Catholic Church hierarchy and the Spanish conquistadores, or the conquerors. And we get what is known as the triangle of power developing in Latin America, where you had a three-way power dynamic between the economic elite, or what became the oligarchy, the very, very few people owning the vast majority of the land and the economy, the military that kept particularly the Indians, but then later the other people, the poor people in their place, and then the church that preached a theology of you will get, this life is full of suffering and turmoil, and your reward will come in the next life. The best thing you can do in this life is be patient, and God will reward you in the next life. So very convenient for keeping people in their place. This kind of church dynamic, and there were, obviously we're going to do some broad generalizations and oversimplifications. There were some prophetic voices that protested against this. Particularly in the early 1500s, there was a bishop in Nicaragua who protested against the treatment of the Indians and was put to death by the military for doing so. So there were some early prophetic voices that saw a different side of the church. But by and large, the church existed in the midst of and for the wealthy and the powerful. The schools that educated the powerful and the elite were run by the church, and this was a very small elite. Very different than the kind of heritage that we have in this country with the town meeting taking place in the church and a much more egalitarian emphasis on democracy. This continued pretty much uninterrupted until the 1820s, when throughout Latin America you have the first major political liberation movements that seek political independence from Spain and Portugal. And so you have Mexico and the countries throughout Latin America gaining their independence in the 1820s. But as far as what effect this had on the church, it essentially transferred the allegiance of the church from Spain to the local government. And so for the great majority of the people, there was very little difference. The power triangle continued pretty much the same, now with a local oligarchy and government and a local military that the church cooperated with, but still cooperated very closely in keeping the poor in particular in their place, which then allowed the whole colonial system to flourish. In the mid-1930s, we hit the second then trend within the Latin American church, which was a liberal or reformist church. And I won't spend a lot of time on this, but during this time in the 1900s, you have the beginnings of the development of a middle class in Latin America. It takes place in Latin America much later than it does in Europe and in the United States. You start to see a middle class developing. You see a church that's beginning to emphasize reform movements now and is beginning to question its role in always repressing or keeping people down and always preaching a theology of the next life. And so you start to see a church that's interested in some reform and supporting labor unions and education that has a broader appeal. And for the Latin American situation, the important thing that comes out of this is the Christian democracy movement. In country after country in Latin America, you have the founding of Christian democratic parties that essentially are parties of the middle class, of educated people in the professionals, businesses, that have started Christian democracy. And in country after country, by the 60s, this then becomes the power of the political party that comes to power. A good example today is President Duarte in El Salvador, the member of the Christian Democratic Party, a party that comes out of this trend of the church. As far as their relationship, it is a very similar kind of relationship to the other one, the earlier trend, in that it works as still with an alliance between the church and the ruling powers. The difference is now there's an emphasis on reform and changing the situation, but it still works within an alliance between the church and government. Any questions before I move into the next one? Because I want to focus most of our attention on that.
Were there other people in the early Christian Democracy Party? Were there any particular leader people
specifically? That we would recognize here?
Yeah.
The government in particular in the early 60s, for example, in Venezuela, many of the governments that, as I'll talk about here, that fell into dictatorship in the 60s were Christian democratic governments that then were overthrown by the military. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But in Chile that happened, in Argentina, and in Brazil, a number of the different countries at that time. There are a lot of strong rivalry between here, because what you're seeing is this period here is the landed oligarchy, the people that came over and started the large plantations, had family wealth for generations and generations. The people that came out of this one was more the self-made person who, through education, through business interests, the emerging middle class was challenging the domination of the upper classes. Pretty much unaffected by both of these are the lower classes, which in Latin America is the vast majority of the people that are very poor. Okay, what I find very exciting and that I'll focus on today for the most part is this third trend, because that will set up the context for understanding what is happening in Latin America today with all of the social turmoil that's going on. And this is what has been called the liberationist trend or movement. A couple things I want to talk about in terms of background to understand how this got started in Latin America. The effect of the theology that came in this early church was very, very complete in many ways in Latin America, and so you have lots of social conflict and turmoil going on through the centuries, but most of it taking place within the ruling classes or the emerging middle classes, and the effect on the majority of the people was one of quiescence, where people just got along and didn't object too much. This begins to change a lot in the 60s. In the background, the first of the two effects that I think are important to mention. First one is the whole Vatican II conference within the Catholic Church. This is where the Catholic Church itself begins to challenge its earlier understanding of the theology that came out of the Counter-Reformation. And nowhere has this had a more dramatic effect than in Latin America. A number of things came out of the Second Vatican Council. It went from 1962 to 1965. But the major overall effect was it served to re-inject the Catholic Church into the world. Up until this point, the Catholic Church had pretty always emphasized its separateness, sort of seeing itself as the mystical body of Christ, but distinct from the rest of the world. And Vatican II served to take the Church and focus it outwardly into the world and orient it in that direction. The Church now becomes redefined as the people of God rather than the mystical body of Christ. It emphasizes the people who are the people of God. And for the first time in many, many centuries, it articulates an important and valid role for the laity. I mentioned before the strong dualism between clergy and laity. And the Church really was seen, if any of you grew up Catholic and received kind of the traditional Catholic teaching, there were sort of three levels. You had the clergy, you had married laity, and then you had the poor folks who somehow didn't get married. They're single at the bottom. And that was a very classical understanding. That's turned on its head. And instead, we're seen as the people of God, with everyone having a distinct but equally important role. One of the most important things is that both the Mass and the Bible now become available in the vernacular, in the local language. I grew up Catholic, and I remember very well when we, for the first time, I think I was 8 years old or so, the first time I ever heard the Mass said in English, first time I understood what the Mass actually had said. But always it had been in Latin. And now the Bible is being translated into the local languages, so people are hearing it and have the opportunity to read it on their own. The other thing that was very important that came out of Vatican II was a new concern for the social situation. This came out in many different areas, but specifically the bishops were told to go back to their own local situations and study it, begin to learn what their situation was like so they understood the context that made up the Church in that area. And nowhere did people take this more seriously than in Latin America, and probably, as we'll see later, no more critical time than in the 60s for this to take place. But the bishops took this seriously, went back to their local areas, and began to study what was happening in order to understand how the Church was relating in that situation. A lot more I can say about Vatican II, but I think those are the important things for understanding the trend, that the Church is re-injected into the world, and now that the laity within the Church has access both to the Mass and to the Bible. The other very important thing for Latin America was the whole decade of the 1960s. This was officially declared the United Nations Decade of Development. There was a real feeling following the World War II, coming out of World War II and the decade of the 50s, that if the what was emerging then and being understood for the first time as the Third World, if the development could take place in the Third World, it could be brought up to the same level as the First World. And so a lot of emphasis on development to bring the poorer nations up to the standard of living of the wealthier nations. The United Nations designed a number of different programs. In Latin America, however, the most important programs were those carried out by the United States. We've had traditionally a very involved relationship with Latin American countries, and this, particularly under the Kennedy administration, took place with the whole Alliance for Progress program, which many of you may remember and be familiar with. But a very interesting thing happened that set the whole context for how the Alliance for Progress program was designed. I'll write up another date for folks to. What happened in 1959 that shook at least this hemisphere, if not much of the world? And it wasn't Sputnik. Sputnik was 57. But anyone want to venture a guess?
Bay of Pigs?
Okay, Bay of Pigs is a few years later, but Bay of Pigs takes place on what happened in 1969, which was the Cuban, 1959, the Cuban revolution takes place. And this then redefines the United States' relationship to all its neighbors in Latin America. Because apart from 1959, the United States foreign policy in Latin America is built on preventing another Cuba taking place. In fact, I think if you read the papers today about what's happening in Nicaragua, time and again, the bottom line is we must prevent Nicaragua from becoming another Cuba. But this then becomes the cornerstone for building a foreign policy towards Latin America, is in order to prevent another Cuba. The Alliance for Progress program was built on two different poles. One was economic aid and one was military aid. The first one in economic aid was the feeling that if we could just develop the economies in these countries and get them growing, that that would be able to solve a lot of the poverty and a lot of the social problems which had caused the revolution in Cuba. So it was, again, a preventive measure. If we can just simply get the economies to grow, we can siphon off the discontent, the reasons why there was social revolution. But the second that was integral to this was the whole military wing of the program, which was designed and aimed at counterinsurgency. It was to put in place a military mechanism that would prevent dissent and social criticism from building before these other programs had a chance to dissipate them or siphon them off. And so you see a lot of strengthening of the local, of the militaries in each country, and emphasizing counterinsurgency, emphasizing not foreign threats, but threats from within each country. So they essentially become armed police forces in each country. Well, the effect of this in Latin America was dramatic. The 1960s, some of you may remember, Latin America was the area of the world that economically grew the fastest. It grew unlike any other part of the world, and you had countries that typically were growing at rates of 10 and 12 and even 15% a year. Just phenomenal economic growth as they took off. You had the miracle economy of Brazil and a number of the countries that just boomed during this time. But paradoxically, the social turmoil and social unrest in these countries was growing at equally, if not greater, rates. And what was happening that these programs had not addressed, they had addressed how to get the economy to boom and how to get them to grow, and they were phenomenally successful in that. But they did not address the whole question of social distribution of the resulting wealth. And so what began to happen was that you had an economy that maybe started off at this level and moved up to this level. But that's only looking at the overall economy. As far as what happened to the people, you had 10% of the people or so that grew phenomenally wealthy. But the majority of the people at the end of the 1960s actually found themselves much worse off than they had at the beginning of the 60s. The poverty level was higher, the unemployment was much, much higher as you begin to industrialize what were formerly agrarian-based countries. And so as the majority of the people began to get worse and worse off, the social unrest and the protests began to develop in each one of these countries. And this then becomes important for understanding that second arm of the Alliance for Progress program, which was the military counterinsurgency emphasis. Because as the social unrest began to build, the militaries in each one of these countries began to be alarmed at the kind of protest and labor movements that were developing. And country after country during the 1960s, we see military coups taking place. The first one being in 1964 in Brazil, where you have a military coup that overthrows the democratically elected government. But soon you have similar situations taking place in Argentina and Uruguay and Chile, throughout Latin America, until by the end of the 1960s, the early 70s, there are only one or two countries in all of Latin America that are not under some form of military government or dictatorship. So the result of what's happening in the 1960s, I lay this out because this is the context then that the bishops who were at Vatican II came back to. They came back to a context of incredible social unrest, booming economies, but deepening unemployment and social problems for the majority of their people, and then military dictatorship in country after country. They began to take seriously what Vatican II had said, which was to go back and study your situations to understand how the church relates in that kind of environment. And in 1968, we have a conference that takes place in Medellin, Colombia, which is one of, if not the most important events in the history of the church, at least in this century in Latin America. It's come to be known sort of the Vatican II of the Latin American church. What it was the second Bishops' Conference. They had met in the 50s earlier and talked a lot about the doctrine and the theology. But in 1968, all the bishops from Mexico all the way down to Argentina gathered in Medellin, Colombia for a conference to address the situation of the church. And by this point, the conditions I've been talking about had reached some of their gravest points. And out of this conference was remarkable for the, if you're, I, are there other people here who grew up Catholic? And then some of you may remember just the kinds of, you know, doctrine and catechism things we were emphasized for us. The thing that was so remarkable about the Medellin Conference was how seriously it took the concrete reality of the church and began to look very, very carefully at what was happening. In particular, there was one priest who was a theologian who was working with many of the bishops to try and articulate this, a man named Father Gustavo Gutierrez. He's become known as the father of liberation theology, and as a very influential man. He's a priest from Peru, half Indian, half Hispanic. But he had been trying to address theologically what was happening throughout the 60s, and he began to work with the bishops at the Medellin Conference to address this. Again, many, many things came out of the final documents of Medellin, but I'll just emphasize a few of the major points. There were three, what I would call three major breakthroughs for the church, particularly in contrast with the two other trends that I mentioned. The first was a rupture from the church as an institution with the existing social and political structures. For 4.5 centuries, the church has been a partner in them, and now it makes a break with them and begins to criticize the existing social and political structures. And it does this by paying attention to something that it coins for the first time, the whole question of what the church now calls institutionalized violence. Traditional church teaching on violence has dealt up to this point pretty much exclusively with interpersonal kind of violence, myself doing harm to a neighbor through a violent action. But the church now looks at an earlier, a deeper level and begins to understand a different kind of violence, which they call institutionalized. It was what the church recognized as violence were societies that were so structured that the majority of the people, or any percentage of the people, were condemned to poverty and misery simply by the way the society was structured. I can just give you a very brief kind of hypothetical example. If, for example, sociologists study and say that for a family of four to have the basic minimum level of living, that the wage earner needs to earn $4 an hour to attain that. And the minimum wage is set at 60 cents an hour in a country. What the church began to say was that structure is institutionalizing violence because it's condemning people in the working class to have to live far below even a subsistence level. And that then becomes the root for the cause for many of the other problems we associate with poverty that lead them to another level of violence, which is the poor reacting to the violence they're forced to live into. But the church did this then by condemning and criticizing the social system that it had always been a partner to in developing. The second major breakthrough that took place in Medellin was the church's unabashed and upfront commitment to the poor. And for the first time in church documents, we hear the phrase that now many of us are familiar with, which is called the preferential option for the poor. The church, part of it is, has a lot of it comes out of Vatican II. Vatican II said if we are going to be the people of God, we need to understand who we are as a people. The Latin American bishops came back to Latin America and said, as a people, we are very poor. You know, over 80% of our people live in poverty. Therefore, that is part of what it means to be the people of God, is to recognize that we are an impoverished people. And so the church now, looking at the scriptures, and looking at its own reality, those two, weighing them together, begins to take seriously texts and scriptures such as Jesus in his first public address saying, I have come to preach good news to the poor, and makes a stated, explicit, preferential option for the poor and commitment to the poor, and sees itself as an institution, as the servant of the poor. So we see almost a flip-flop of what had the earlier models have been, where the church was an elite that worked with the other elites in order to keep the poor down. Now the church is saying that its identity is involved in being the servant of the poor, of understanding itself as the people of God. In this commitment, there is a real emphasis now on community participation and what became known as liberating education. Liberating education, the church began to define, is education that helps the poor to change things themselves, so that the church or government structures and so forth are not always doing things for the poor or doing things to the poor, but rather are empowering the poor to take charge of their own lives and change things for themselves. And a whole new model of community life, church life, develops on this understanding of education. Then the last thing that goes sort of hand in hand with this, which is what really shook Latin America to its roots, was the church made a frontal attack on what it called neocolonialism and capitalism. I mentioned before, the church had always been the partner in the kind of social and economic and political system. Now it steps back and begins to critique them and attack them. Neocolonialism is the recognition in Latin America that in the 1820s, Latin American countries gained their political independence. But economically, they became even more dependent on the countries of the North Atlantic region, the United States and Britain and other countries in Europe. And so they began to use the term neocolonialism, which said that while we have political independence, we have economic dependency. And the church begins to critique this and say this is one of the reasons why the violence and the poverty is engulfing our area, and that capitalism, which has served to so greatly enrich the first world countries, the flip side of the wealth of those countries is the poverty of our countries. So begin to tie the social problems in Latin America. The international order of which it was a part. But you can imagine what this was like for the other two members of the triangle to hear. For 450 years, they have had a church which has cooperated with them in every way to maintain a system that has kept them wealthy and in power. And now the economic elite and the military are seeing a frontal attack being carried out by them, against them by the church. What happened then is the decade of the 70s. And I'll spend some more time on that in some of the other sessions, particularly when we look at El Salvador and try to understand why El Salvador has gotten where it is today. The decade of the 70s is where El Salvador, the people in El Salvador, begin to take seriously what happened in Medellin and begin to put that into place in their own country in developing cooperatives among the peasants and labor movements and so forth to reclaim some rights for the poor. And then the other two members of the triangle, the military and the oligarchy, feeling betrayed by the church and reacting against them. But I think I'll stop for now with this kind of framework. The thing I want to point out is while these happen historically in a sequence, all three of these tendencies are present in the church today. And you'll see all kinds of those theology. And I think it'll help us understand, for example, the dynamic of what's going on in, say, Nicaragua or El Salvador, when we can look at the different characters and see which part of the church they find themselves in. It'll help understand how they're relating to each other and where the tensions may be coming from. Tomorrow, I want to focus more on the church that I mentioned that's coming out of the Medellin Conference in 1968. We'll look at the base communities, and we'll look at what's being called the Church of the Poor and how it's developing its life in the last 20 years or so. But I think right now I'll stop and just see if there are questions or points that need to be clarified. I know I'm covering an awful lot of territory quickly here.
When you mentioned that the military took over a number of these countries after, I assume they had some democratic elections or something and certain people had been elected, and then when the military took over, did they reinstate with a more firm position those elected positions, or did they change them from what they were elected to something different?
In most cases, the military took over completely and established a military dictatorship. Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up, because there's what begins to develop in Latin America is what's called the doctrine of national security. I think this is particularly important for us, for we as U.S. citizens begin to understand, because we're hearing a lot more about this now in our own context. But it was first developed within Latin America with help from U.S. military advisors and also in Brazil. The doctrine of national security is a whole doctrine, a whole way of thinking that sees the world as a place of struggle between atheistic communism and Western Christian civilization. And this was what was used to justify the military intervention in each of these countries. Oftentimes the military would say the church has abandoned Western civilization, therefore we are the only institution left to protect the Christian Western values, and therefore justified overthrowing the government because they feared that the government was leading them into socialism or they were being attacked by communism. The typical pattern was to overthrow the democracies and establish a military dictatorship. Brazil is a very good example because it's only been a little over a year ago that they had their first president elected, a non-military leader since 1964. So they had over 20 years of military dictatorship. Argentina has had 3 years now after several years. Chile is still under General Pinochet. Since 1973, they've had a military dictatorship. One of the books the bookstore always asks me to plug these, but the bookstore, I should mention, has an incredible selection of books on Latin America and the church that's emerging there. But I'll mention a couple of them here that relate particularly to what we're talking about. One is a book called Cry of the People by a woman, Penny Lerneau, who's a journalist in Latin America. And it's called The Struggle for Human Rights in Latin America, The Catholic Church in Conflict with U.S. Policy. It's one of the best analyses I've ever seen of how this doctrine of national security began to develop and how it affected country after country after country in Latin America and how it continues to affect what's happening there. I recommend this book wholeheartedly. It has an entire chapter on the doctrine of national security. The other book that's very, very good for understanding the political situation in particular is one by Walter Lefebvre called Inevitable Revolutions, the United States and Central America. And it gives a much more detailed analysis of the kind of thing I was talking about in terms of the decade of the 60s, how all the economic aid programs and the military aid programs provided the very recipe that guaranteed that there would be revolutions in countries throughout Latin America. Then a couple other books I'll mention, I'll mention them later on, we'll talk about them. If people are interested in knowing more about Latin American liberation theology, and I'll spend a session on Wednesday on doing that, but Robert McAfee Brown has a very, very good book called Theology in a New Key, where he tries to respond to and explain Latin American liberation theology for North Americans. And particularly, he's very close friends with Gustavo Gutierrez, the fellow I mentioned who was at the Medellin conference. And the last book I'll mention is one by a colleague of mine, Jack Nelson Palmyre, who has worked a lot with the American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church in America, called The Politics of Compassion. Just has come out. And Jack has just finished living in Nicaragua for 2 years, but talks a lot about the situation. For example, Central America, a call to conversion, looking at a number of the different roots of the conflict there. And if anyone else is in the bookstore sometime, feel free to nab me and just take a look, because there are some very, very good books, depending on what your interests are.
Are there any countries that are not experiencing in Latin America or have been the least amount of trouble with this?
Within Central America in particular, there's one very good example, and that's the country of Costa Rica, which is, to bring my map to show, but it's the country just immediately south of Nicaragua. And Costa Rica has had, Costa Rica had a very interesting revolution in 1948. It's the only revolution I ever know of that the winning side disarmed itself. And they put in their constitution that it was illegal to have a standing army in Costa Rica. So since 1948, they've had nearly 40 years of uninterrupted elections every 4 years. And so that is a sharp contrast to what has happened in the other countries. Costa Rica has experienced many of the same social turmoils, economic problems in the other countries, but they've never had a military to appeal to, and so they've never had a military coup take place. One of the things I find most frightening about what's happening in Central America now is the whole regionalization of the conflict there, and the Reagan administration, well, Jean Kirkpatrick, when she was involved in the Reagan administration, had a very famous line when someone asked her if they were going to give aid, economic aid to Costa Rica, and she said if they're willing to take military aid, we'll also give them economic aid. Because what the Reagan administration has been trying to do is convince Costa Rica to build an army again, so it has an army on the southern flank of Nicaragua. And in Costa Rica, there's a very strong right-wing movement now that is developing this whole doctrine of national security for Costa Rica, calling for the establishment of an army in order to fight communism. And for me, I lived in Costa Rica before. That's a very frightening development. But up until this point, they have been the wonderful exception to the rule.
Dan?
Yeah.
You talk a lot about Vatican II and its effect in changing of economic policy. How do you see the present Pope in terms of becoming more conservative, at least in moral issues and morality? How that affects Central America presently, or has in any conference kind of over encompassed all of that? Although he has called people into his sight from Central America.
Yeah, I should. That's a really interesting question. I want to talk about it more too when we talk about liberation theology, because the Pope's very interesting relation to that.
Mm-hmm.
The decade of the 1970s was a period in which the church began to really take the ball and run with it after the Medellin conference, as I mentioned. And what happened was the Medellin conference had a lot of support from almost all sections of the church. In the decade that after it, this, particularly the conservative church, began to really get concerned. Like, what have we let loose on this continent? And so there was a whole movement in the conservative sectors of the church to repeal what happened at Medellin. And the next bishops' conference in 1979 took place in Puebla, Mexico. So you hear about the Puebla conference. And it was a very, very well-calculated attempt by the traditional church to peel back and roll back what happened in Medellin. This was also one of the first years that the current pope was in power, and he came over to Latin America, the first pope to visit Mexico and preach at that conference. I'll say just briefly that the conference ended up being kind of a stalemate between these two trends. These folks were not able to peel back everything, but they did get into more of the traditional language, and the liberation folks, most of whom were not allowed to attend the conference, through a whole bunch of political maneuvering, were kept out of the conference, were able to kind of hold the line with some sympathetic bishops. But the Pope is a very interesting fellow. He's very alarmed at the liberation theology movement because of what he sees as the Marxist influence in it. And from his own situation in Poland, where Marxism has been very repressive for the church, that's very difficult for him to see. On the other hand, he has a very well-articulated and strong standpoint of the church of the poor, of the church having to be the advocates for the poor, and that's what he preached about in 1979. And so it's not as if he can ignore the poor and the poverty and the poor's attempts to change it, but he's alarmed. So he's always kind of stepping out and saying stop, and then he's coming back and saying we are the church and we need to be on your side. So it's a very kind of ambivalent position he's in. But we can talk about a little bit more maybe in the liberation theology talk.
If I understand what you said, you talked about the economic development offered by the United States, which increased the economy of the country, but then that's even worse for the poor people. And you say, I think you're saying that laid the groundwork for revolution. If the revolution did not come from the poor, it came from the military. Were the military then really acting on behalf of the poor, or were they using the poor as an excuse for establishing their own victory?
Okay. I should be a little clearer, I'll have to ask you what you mean by revolution. I distinguish between military coups, which the military taking power, and as opposed from revolution, which is a broad social movement that has an armed component to it, but also has incorporated many sectors of society. That can later then be used by the emerging military to gain control.
It seems to me we got the coup and not the grassroots revolution.
Okay, but what has happened is that, for example, what's happened in Central America is the civil war that's developed in El Salvador, the revolution in Nicaragua, a civil war that developed in Guatemala. In country after country, broad-based social movements of protest and revolution developed in the 70s in response to what had happened in the 60s. Some of them, they were crushed. Some of them, they're still in a stalemate. And some of them, they were successful. But in country after country, this dynamic emerged where you took formerly quiet populations, and now they have, through broad spectrum of the population, have revolted. And I can give you just one very brief example of what I mean by this the impoverishment of the many at the enriching of a few. In Latin, in El Salvador in the early 60s, El Salvador had, I don't know the exact statistics, but somewhere on the order of 15% of its people were landless. That's serious enough, and in a country that is an agrarian-based country where people depend on the land to survive. But at the end of the 1960s and the early 70s, through this whole effort at industrialization and expanding, for example, cash crops, an effort to get the economy going, over half of El Salvador's population was now landless. And so over half of the people that depend on the land to live no longer had access to the land. What that does then is it creates a very large labor force that the emerging industries can use to keep wages low, because you have 40%, 50% unemployment, and therefore you can keep wages down because of demand for that. But that's the kind of thing that happened throughout the country. The industrialization that took place forced many, many peasants off the land, and you had an impoverishment of many, many people. I certainly can. I planned sessions on Nicaragua and El Salvador.
I'm just somewhat curious, since I've not been down there. I have a member of my congregation who is in Honduras, and she was quite excited about the fact that they're going to be offering a trip in February, which encouraged me to go, and I said, would you like to go with me? And she said, oh, I'd love to, but I wouldn't dare. And I've been wanting to go and talk with her more about that.
Yeah, Honduras is a very interesting. It would be fun just to do a session that just looked at each country and how they're fitting together. Maybe we can do that after set some of the other context. Honduras is traditionally been the poorest of the countries in Central America, and has had many of the other dynamics that we talked about here. Although the poverty has been more across the board, it has not developed a very large economic elite. Primarily because Honduras's wealth in the last 150 years has been in foreign hands, first in British hands and then in U.S. hands. And so Honduras was a typical banana republic. It literally was run by the banana companies, which were U.S. and then multinational owned. As a result, it hasn't developed the huge split in poverty and wealthy that many of the other countries are, and so it hasn't had as much social turmoil. In the last 5 or 10 years, there has been a very great increase in the power of the military there. And up until 2 years ago, many, many disappearances, assassinations, human rights violations, there was a tremendous climate of fear. Honduras has now become the key player in U.S. policy in Central America, because Honduras is the only country that shares a border with Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, which are the countries the U.S. is most concerned about there. And so it now hosts over 3,000 U.S. soldiers, more or less permanently. There have been 9 major Air Force bases built by the U.S. in the last 4 years there. It has become essentially an occupied country by the United States military. And what has gone hand in hand with that is the strengthening of the Honduras military. And so that people, there is a lot more fear there now. And many people have left the country and are afraid of going back.
What's the government doing?
An elected civilian government. They just had their second elections this past November, which is the first time in, I forget, like 30 or 40 years that a civilian president actually succeeded another civilian president. But elections don't necessarily mean the same thing for democracy in Latin America that we associate them with here. And what has happened in many of the countries, from my perspective, such as El Salvador and Honduras, is it's been very convenient to get elections to take place to call it a democracy. At the same time, the military has been strengthened, so it's actually the military who's in control, but there's an elected civilian president. And I think in Honduras, clearly the military is much more in control there. We've had cases where the presidents have either denied, for example, that the Nicaraguan Contras are there, or have opposed them, and yet they're simply overruled by the military, both the U.S. presence and the Honduran military there. But it does have a civilian president.
Many people think that you have to have a broad-based universal education of people before you can have anything like what we would call democracy. Talking about the role of the church, hasn't the Catholic Church been the chief educator of Latin American people? And what has happened in Catholic education in those countries?
Catholic Church throughout the centuries has been the chief educator of a minority. The vast majority of the people in Latin America never had any formal education. But as far as the wealthy and maybe middle class that the Catholic Church has admired far and away, the educator of those people, that is what began to change in the 60s and the 70s, was the Catholic Church began to stress education throughout the church. And when we talk about the Church of the Poor tomorrow, I can go into more detail. But well, let me just mention a couple things that began to happen. A few more minutes here. I mentioned to you the demographics of the church, that it is a church unlike we understand it. And the ratio, for example, when I was in the Dominican Republic, has over 6 million Catholics. It has 150 Dominican priests and 250 foreign priests there, but about 400 priests to cover a country of 6 million Catholics. And so you have parishes that have 100,000, 80,000 people in them. Those people are lucky to see the priest once every 5 years, let alone have any kind of relationship with the priest. And so they'd have to devise all sorts of different strategies. But the bishops, when they came back from Vatican II, began to look at this as part of their reality and began to devise strategies that now would involve the lay people in carrying out the functions of the church. One of the movements that began to develop was called the Delegates of the Word, which was an idea of taking people, lay people, from the local level, the village or wherever local level, training them within the church to do everything short of actually blessing and ministering the sacraments, but training them to teach, training them to work with their people, and then go back into the local communities. The advantage that this had was that people were coming out of communities where they were already well known, they understood the dynamics that were going on there, and they were accepted when they came back. This Delegates of the Word movement trained thousands and thousands of lay leaders throughout the Catholic Church that then went back, and they began doing things, very simple things, such as teaching their people to read and write, teaching their people to read the Bible, beginning to reflect on their local situation there, what were some of the problems. And out of this then began the organization, the organizing that became so threatening to the status quo. These are the Delegates of the Word were the ones who were responsible for the whole phenomenon of faith communities going. These lay leaders went back to their communities, formed small grassroots groups of people that then began to reflect together on the Bible. And so it's that level of education then really for the first time began to reach the masses. And you have, this is then what in turn what becomes so threatening to the oligarchy and the military, is that for the first time you have poor people who are starting to read and write. They're learning to read the Constitution. For the first time they understand many of these countries have wonderful constitutions that guarantee rights to all these people, but the people have never known it. And now they're beginning to read that and understand that. They're looking at their legal rights, the right to organize, the right to protest. And out of this then becomes the whole organized protest and opposition movements, which then become crushed. And so on that level, the Catholic Church is very much involved in educating and what they consider is preparing people for democracy. It's a fascinating talk. It was worth this whole talk. I hadn't planned necessarily any particular place for it. But let me think about where we could stick that in, because that is the two most rapidly growing movements within the church in Latin America. One are the base communities, this grassroots church, but the other one are the fundamentalist churches. And I mentioned again that the Latin American church is very different than our understanding of church. The historical churches, as we understand them in this country, such as Lutheran or Presbyterian or Methodist, basically are non-existent. They exist, but they're very small churches in most of the countries in Latin America. Over 80% of the Protestants in Latin America are Pentecostal or fundamentalist. So of the Protestant churches, they're very, very much associated with the Pentecostal fundamentalist movement. And there's tremendous influence of the North American fundamentalist churches in Latin America. Financially. And for example, Jimmy Swaggart. Every place you go in Latin America, Jimmy Swaggart is being broadcast over the radio.
But financially, it's influenced.
Yeah, well, for example, Guatemala is a good example. There are more fundamentalist preachers in Guatemala who are funded by North American churches than there are priests in all of Guatemala, even though Guatemala is still 90% Catholic. But there's just a tremendous influx of dollars. And of course, with that comes a very, very strong anti-communist ideology. Again, that very much that theology of things will be given to you in the next life if you're patient and suffer in this life. many of your original Catholic teaching kind of theology is present in the fundamentalist one, but a very strong anti-communist ideology. I'm sorry, what? I don't know what the Duarte was, but there was a ruler in Guatemala named Rios Montt, Ephraim Rios Montt, in 1982-83, which was, he was a member of a sect out of California called something Church of God. I forget what that was, and so the Pentecostals and Fundamentalists blossomed during that time. At the same time, they had the most incredible massacre of Indians. During his 2 to 3 year rule, there were somewhere between 35,000 and 70,000 Indians killed in Guatemala, and pretty much justified by this theology. I think we better close it off here and let people close up, but look forward to some of you can come back tomorrow morning. We'll be talking about more of the Church of the Poor of these communities. Thanks. Should also be in the library too if you want to read them all today.
Thank you.
with Mauricio and his wife just a few days
ago. Yeah, she was up there. She was staying up there.
It was something because Concepcion just kicked me out right away,
yeah.
And this was inseparable. And her mother's day reminds
absolutely.
Her so much of Mauricio, her godfather. This was back in October when they hadn't been killed yet.
Yeah.
And so she
yeah.
were on my shoulder,
yeah.
And I speak
yeah.
Spanish, so we
yeah.
talked
right.
a lot.
I said, what she said to you, she probably said to me, but I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we walked around all day and together,
yeah. It's a beautiful
yeah.
This is so schematic, but I'm just trying to draw the main themes.
Yeah,
I guess you did eventually get some sort of stuff.
It's kind of complex, but the theology that he brought is one very much of not only anti-communist, but anti, or very, very sharp distinction between Christians, including born-again Christians, and other people who are pagans or infidels or somehow separated out, a very sharp distinction. When Rios Montt came into power, he came in as a general, came into a military coup, things improved somewhat in the cities. The death squad killing and so forth went down in the cities, but the army was just let loose.